Okay, so today I'll be giving a brief summary on some of the things I've been working on over the past couple of years. So, to give a broad outline there, so there's the areas of Hamiltonian implementation, where you have multiple parties implementing evolution on multi-partite Hamiltonian using entanglement. There's Hamiltonian simulation, which means essentially doing the same thing, but doing it on a state that's encoded in qubits on the quantum computer. Then there's a lot of the issues in phase measurements. There's the single mode phase measurements, which includes the optimal adaptive time measurements of a fixed phase, and also continuous adaptive measurements, which is tracking a fluctuating phase, and adaptive measurements in interferometry, and more recently, interferometry with multiple passes, which actually achieves the Heisenberg unit, and we had that experimentally demonstrated at Griffith University in Australia, and it was just published in Nature in November. And also some areas I won't be going over today, there's capacities, which is mainly on the capacities of the unitary operations that act on the systems that are in position of different parties. So look at, for example, how much entanglement you can create with these unitaries and how much classical communication you can form with multiple applications of unitary and encoding and decoding and so forth. There's also processing of single photon sources, which is where the idea is you have multiple single photon sources which have a combination of the vacuum and a single photon, and there's some possible coherence there. And we look at what you can do with the combining multiple sources and with beam splitters and post-selecting on the certain measurement results and so forth. And very recently, looked at Bell inequalities with loss, where the idea is you are looking at what sorts of loss are acceptable in Bell inequalities, and we actually found that the types of loss that that Bell inequalities can tolerate are more general than the usual desampling assumption. But for this talk, I'll be looking at these areas here. So for Hamiltonian implementation, the idea is you have n parties, each of which shares part of this target system, and you want to implement the unitary, which is evolution under that Hamiltonian, on all of those in target set. And as a resource, you have these ancillas, which are going to be in some entangled state. So, for a very simple example of this, there's the CNOC teleportation from Vendelovic's paper, where you have two teleportations followed by a CNOC, which you can commute back through the correction operations for these Bell measurements, and so you essentially have two maximally entangled states to do a CNOC between, which gives you an entangled resource state, and then given that entangled resource state, you can deterministically perform the CNOC. So there's a Serac scheme, which is a generalization of this, where you have a U of alpha, which is evolution under a sigma x tends to sigma x Hamiltonian, and that gives you an entangled resource state at this stage, but unlike the case of the CNOC, you can't always correct for the Bell measurement results. So as well as getting the U of alpha, you might get a U of minus alpha in there, which you can't actually correct for, and you actually get that with the 50% probability. So the way you actually go about implementing this U of alpha is if you get a failure and you get a U of minus alpha, what you try to do is you try to implement the U of 2 alpha. That fails, that succeeds, and overall you get a U of alpha. If it fails, you try and implement a U of 4 alpha and so forth. And eventually, if you have alpha being of the form pi on 2 to the n, then the correction that you're going to need is actually local, so you can do that deterministically. So if you look at the actual average entanglement consumption, you have this entanglement for your initial resource state, and then for the next resource state, to try to implement U of 2 alpha, you have an E of 2 alpha in there, but that's weighted with a factor of a half there, so you only need it for 50% probability. And similarly, you have an ear 4 out from 4 for the third resource state, and so forth. And when you do the sum over all of those possible resource states needed, you end up with roughly a 6 times alpha being the upper bound on the average entanglement needed. And this is actually the asymptotic entanglement that's needed in the limit of small alpha as well. So in the case of more general alpha, you can just express the alpha as a sum over these alpha ends, and then you get the same thing for the same upper limit, and you get this fractal type of curve for the actual average entanglement needed. So for the scheme that I developed is the number of improvements. One is that the ancilla is simplified, so you just have a 2-qubit entangled state rather than a 4-qubit entangled state, and it's simple to use this statal notation because it means you don't have to explicitly include your system state in there. So the idea with the stator is that it's a tensor product of the operation with a state, and if you're applying a stator to a target state, you're just applying those unitaries to the target and then adding this state as a tensor product to the resulting state. So you can see that the resource state and the operation are examples of the stators. So if you do controlled phase operations between the ancilla and target, you're going from that resource state to that stator, and you're essentially now wanting to get rid of these ancillas. And you can do this fairly simply for the first one. You just do a Hadamard followed by a computational basis, which is equivalent to an X vision. And then the Alice does that on her qubit and then transmits the result to Bob. And since Bob still has an ancilla there, he can correct the phase. But then the next step, Bob's also trying to get rid of his ancilla, but he again gets a plus or minus sign in there. And in the case of the minus sign, he can't correct it. But that's just getting a unit minus alpha, which is similar to the case of Seurat's scheme. So you can again use a chain of corrections in the case where you get failures. So that's the first part. The second part is to actually reduce the average entanglement needed. So rather than having a cos alpha and a sine alpha in there, you have some more general beta in there. And usually what you actually do is you take beta to be larger than alpha, which means that the entanglement of this initial resource state is larger than in the case of Seurat's scheme. But the neat thing is that by using this larger entanglement, you get a higher probability of success. So the later entangled states you need at the later stages, which actually have higher entanglement, have a lower rate. So you can select these values of beta such that the average entanglement that you use is reduced. So in this case, you're just doing everything exactly the same as before, except now Bob's projective measurement is modified. So Bob's doing projective measurement in this basis, and provided you appropriately select the gamma there, you find that you get the U of alpha in the case of success. And in the case of failure, you're getting something that's a bit of a mess, but it's again of the class U of alpha, so you can correct it using exactly the same method. So there's a couple of examples of this. One is beta equals alpha, which is the same scheme as before. If you alternatively take beta equal to pi on 4, which means you're actually using a maximally entangled state there, in the case of Bowley, you find that you can just use local operations to turn it into the U of alpha that you want it. So this is a deterministic way of implementing that operation. I'll skip over the example 3. Example 4 is just where you numerically optimize the value of beta at each step to minimize the overall average entanglement consumption. And then you find that in the case of small alpha, your average entanglement consumption is actually about 5.6 alpha, whereas it's almost 6 alpha in the case of Seurat's scheme. And if you plot it for the larger values of alpha, you can see that quite a significant difference between the entanglement consumption of the two cities, as well as having a slightly different slope for small alphabet. The third part is looking at more general Hamiltonians. So the first thing you look at is doing a sigma z pinch ring Hamiltonian, which is equivalent to something that by Nirantsarug. And it, essentially, you can do this with the simplified ancilla just by in an obvious way, just by making things tensor n rather than tensor 2, and you have parties 1 to n minus 1 eliminating their ancilla in the same way as Alice does in the two party case. So, then to go to the case of this tensor product Hamiltonian, what we want to do is look at using this sigma z, the tensor n Hamiltonian, to simulate this this Hamiltonian. And the way to do that is, first of all, you can diagonalize each of these individual Hamiltonians and then perform a chain of simulations where you have sigma z for the first part simulating the first Hamiltonian and so forth. And I won't go into the detail of how you actually do that, but the way you can do that is there's essentially a generalization of the two-party example given in Andrew Children's paper. So when you do that, you find the average entanglement consumption is just has that same 5.6 factor again, except with a norm of H and T embedding. And you can also look at sums of these tensor product Hamiltonians, and you can just use a Taylor expansion and get a sum in the area of this way. So the next, the fourth improvement there is looking at reduced communication. So the idea here is you use a compression approach with many targets and trying to implement this U of L for many times on each of these targets. So the general approach is, at each stage you have many copies of this entangled resource state, and you can expand that out and look at typical sequences in there, and the number of the basis elements for your typical sequences is going as 2 to the power of the entanglement. So essentially what you can do is limit each part into doing a measurement in the Fourier transform basis in the space of typical sequences, and then the number of bits that's needed to communicate the phase correction is just going proportional to the entanglement. And what you find is that the average entanglement, the average communication from each party to the final party for the phase corrections is just the same as entanglement, whereas it's actually something that needs to be something very large in the previous scheme. And but the only drawback to this is the last party actually needs to communicate back to everyone else what the positions and values are, which takes a lot of communication. So although you can work this compression in one direction, the communication back from the final party is actually quite low still. So just to summarise here, there's four main improvements. There's a simplified ancilla, there's reduced entanglement requirement, reduced communication requirement, and multi-part identities. Okay, so the Hamiltonian simulation is related. The idea there is you're trying to you have a state that's represented on qubits in the quantum computer, and you're just trying to simulate the evolution under that Hamiltonian using the usual the quantum computer circuit elements. So I should also thanks to Richard and Nathan Barry for slides in this section, and so just to give a bit of a summary of some of the work that's been done in this area. There was the famous original conjecture in 1982 that you could simulate the physical systems with a quantum computer. This was made formal by Lloyd in 1996, who used a Taylor series expansion and assumed that you had a Hamiltonian which was expressed as a sum where each individual Hamiltonian that sum could be efficiently simulated and showed an efficient algorithm in that case. A more general scenario than this is where rather than just being given your Hamiltonian as a sum, you have a Hamiltonian that's actually sparse, and you can work out, given a column of the Hamiltonian in some matrix representation, what the non-zero elements in that column are. So in that case, Aragon and Tushner showed that you can decompose the Hamiltonian into this many elements, where n is the number of qubits that you're representing your system on, and d is the sparseness, so that's the number of non-zero elements in each lower column. And also they use Lee-Trotter expansion to get power of 3/2 for the time scale. And this was improved on by Andrew Schultz in the following year with a improved n scaling, but the other scalings were unchanged. Then there's our results in last year, published last year, where we had the Lee-Trotter-Suzuki formula for giving scaling for the time that's basically arbitrarily close to linear, and also changing the scaling in n to log star. And this log star is the height of the smallest tower of powers of 2 that exceeds n. So so if you're looking at, say, 65,000 qubits, and it's not exceeding 4, so it's basically extremely close to being constant. Okay, so looking at the higher order integrators first. So with these integrators, there's the simple Trotter formula case where you just have, for example, if you have Hamiltonian just being a sum of two Hamiltonians, then you can divide the time up into r time steps and have this little integrator for each t on r time step, and then take the power of r. And if you and then you have to select the value of r to be large enough to give a certain accuracy. And once you do that, you end up with the number of steps scaling as t to the 3/2. And that's where that t to the 3/2 comes from in that previous work. But if you want to do things more accurately than this, then there's Suzuki's work which shows that if you use these integrators, which are defined by this recursive formula, then you can, for small lambda, get this difference between the exact exponential and this integrator going as lambda to the power of 2k plus 1. And in Suzuki's work, he only shows the order scale. And what we have is the actual exact upper bound on this, which includes all of the terms that it depends on. And when we work that out, and also use this dividing trick with dividing the time by r and taking the power of r, what we get is this result here, where we have this upper bound here, and that tau is just the time scaled by this thing in terms of the norm of dh goes, and this q is worked out in terms of those pk's, which just come from the Suzuki integrators, and these q's are less than 1.
What operating norms are you using?
Yeah. It's just the two norm.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then there's also some restrictions on R, which you don't need to worry about. They're generally easily satisfied. So then the value of R that we take to make this thing not exceed epsilon is given by this expression. And when we plug that in to the formula, we get this thing. So the important thing here is we have the tau, which is proportional to t to the power of 1 plus 1 on 2k, with some restrictions on the parameters that are easily satisfied. And the next thing here is that rather than just giving us the scaling in terms of time, we have we can see how it depends in terms of all of these other parameters. So you might at first think that that you get more accurate results taking pi k, so you just take an enormous value of k, but as you can see, these are 5 to the power of 2 K there as well. So that if you increase K too much, then that scaling is going to be harmful. And you can actually work out an optimal choice for K, and you get approximately this value. And if you plug that back into there, then you get this part, which is just linear in the time. And then you get this part as well, which is actually the scales up more slowly than any the power of the time. So there's also a result which shows that you can't actually simulate things any more efficiently than the linear in the time. And the reason for this is that there's a result that if you are trying to work out the parity of a black box function, you can't work that out any more efficiently than linear in the time. So in what we do is we work out a Hamiltonian such that if you simulate evolution under that Hamiltonian, it's actually working out the parity of that black box function. So what it does is you start out in this blue subspace, and at each step you're either staying in the same subspace or you're switching to the other subspace. And if you stay in the same subspace, if the black box function is giving you 0, and you switch if it gives you 1. So at the end of the simulation, it's going to be rotated up either to there or there, and measuring which subspace you're in actually tells you what the parity of the black box function is. And because you can't work out the parity of that black box function any faster than linear mean, you can't simulate evolution under this Hamiltonian any faster than linear in T. So next part is the actual decomposition of the Hamiltonian. So the idea now is you want to express your sparse Hamiltonian as a sum over the individual Hamiltonians which are 1 sparse, which means they only have 1 non-zero element in any row or column. And what we find is that we can take the total number of these to be the 6 dim squared, then D is the sparseness of Hamiltonian, and to do a query to any of these 8 J's. It takes the of auto log starring queries to these individual H's. So the way we do this is by looking at the Hamiltonian as a graph. So for each column or row number, that corresponds that corresponds to a node, and you have if X is a column number and this Y1 is a row number, then you connect these by an edge if there's a non-zero element of the Hamiltonian there. So the Hamiltonian can be represented as some form of graph, and you can also put numbers around these nodes that correspond to so for example, if this is a column number, then that would be a row number 1, that would be row number non-zero row number 1, non-zero row number 2, non-zero row number 3, etc. And if you have these labelings on these edges symmetric, as in this case, then I should emphasize as well that the idea with this coloring is you want to have different colors that correspond to these different data J's. And if you have no cases where the same color, the two edges of the same colour intersect on the same node, then that means that you have a Hamiltonian that's 1 sparse. So if you have this symmetric case, then you can look at colours corresponding to these numbers around the nodes. So you get this for 1, this for 2, and this for 3, and you get no intersections there. So these would correspond to 3 different 1 sparse Hamiltonians. But the problem is that, as in this example, you don't get those labelings turning out to be symmetric. So we can try to force them to be symmetric by putting in ordered pairs of A and B on these edges. But then we find that we can get examples like this, where we get the same bordered pair on two intersecting edges. So now you can get long the long paths with these cases. So the idea now is to basically look at one of these paths, and for each edge, you start off by adding this the column number at each stage as part of your colour. And this is, if you do it that way, then that's going to give you an unreasonably large number of colours. But we have a neat scheme for going from x's to x primes, where the idea is that we compare for example, the y and z here, and look at the first bit position where bits differ, and for y prime to record the position of that bit and the value of bit for y. Yep.
So can you go back a slide, please?
Yep, sure.
When you say there's a long path, so yep. You're trying to, that's not one sparse, so you're trying to avoid that, right?
Yep.
So it seems like you can get to within a factor of two the edge chromatic number. You can just take that path and break it up into alternating pieces, right?
And yeah, the problem is that how do you know how to alternate it? Because say this path is ridiculously long.
Yeah.
Well, if it was just a finite length, then you could say we're going to count to the end and say make this one red, this one blue, this one red, this one blue, etc. But if it's something that's really, really long, then you're going to have to then keep on tracing along it, and you don't have any bound on how far you're going to have to trace down it.
I see. So you're not necessarily assuming that I have some short description of that path, so I can't just just sort of abstractly say I'm taking every other one.
The idea with this one is you don't actually have to look at the entire path. You can just look at say it only has to be about a long star in long. So.
Okay.
So when you do this scheme, you're iterated. So each of these ones can be represented by n bits, then each of these is log n, and you just basically keep iterating it until there's only six possible alternatives for any of these. So you don't get it down to two, but at least you get it down to six. And the neat thing is that you don't have to actually go all the way to the end to force that.
Okay.
And then the number of times you need to do that is where that long star comes in. And then as well, the actual length of this is long star in. So anyway, so just to summarize this section, so we have this Weintraub and Suzuki integration is giving us very close to the linear in time, the complexity very close to linear in t. And we have this proof that this is essentially optimal because you can't do things sublinear t. And also, we actually have an upper bound which allows us to work out the optimal order. And we also have this the very efficient method of decomposing these sparse Hamiltonians. So that's the first part. And the second part is on phase measurement, which is kind of unrelated. This is mainly work with in collaboration with Howard Wiseman. There's also some work in collaboration with Eleanor Huntington and Jim Pride, etc. So anyway, the general idea with phase measurement is there's two areas that I'll be looking at. One is if you have measurement of a phase of a single mode, and which is the fairly obvious. Then we have also phase of in an interferometer, where it's the phase difference between two arms in that interferometer. So for the first case, you can look at ideal measurements for this, which is given by this PODN, and these are essentially ideal measurements that you don't actually have a experimental method for achieving this, but this is very useful to look at in terms of understanding what the intrinsic phase properties of the state are, and then you can treat a measurement as essentially adding the phase uncertainty to this intrinsic phase uncertainty. And there's a neat result that if you have an upper limit of n on the photon number, you get this result for the phase uncertainty. And for that, that's actually using the Levo phase variance, which is the uncertainty is the square root of this expression, which is useful because it works modulo 2 pi, but it also corresponds to the usual variance for very narrowly peak distributions. And it also has this neat uncertainty principle, which you can use to derive a Heisenberg limit for phase. So the idea is that if you solve for the delta pi there, it can't be any less than 1 on delta n. And so if you go back to having an upper limit of n, then you can't get the phase uncertainty being any less than this 1 on n scale. And as I mentioned in the previous slide, you have this exact result if you're looking at an optimal state. In contrast, the standard quantum limit is just what you get from a coherent state. And if you look at a simple method of measuring phase, you get a 1 on root n scaling for the phase uncertainty. And this is also what you get if you're looking at these ideal measurements of phase as well. So you have this square root of difference between your standard quantum limit and the Heisenberg limit. And I should also emphasise as well that at some stages I'll be mentioning this in terms of variance. So you have a 1 on n for the standard quantum limit for the variance, and a 1 on n squared for the standard quantum for the Heisenberg limit for the variance. Anyway, so looking at how you actually go about doing real measurements of phase, if you're looking at a single mode, then you're generally combining it with some strong local oscillator field that has some phase that you select, and you're combining it on a beam splitter and using photodetectors to give you your estimate of phase. And usually there's two scenarios. One is you have some sort of linear variation of this local oscillator phase that doesn't depend in any way on your system phase, and that actually is giving you a fairly inaccurate measurement, and it's never going to beat the standard quantum limit. And if you want to beat the standard quantum limit, what people usually look at is a homodyne measurement, where you're trying to take this local oscillator phase to be close to the input phase of the input state. But you can see the problem there is that you actually need to have an estimate of the phase to go about trying to measure the phase. So that's where this adaptive measurement set that Howard Wiseman and Knight developed came in. So the idea is generally that you have some long mode and you use detections of the first part of the mode to give you some rough estimate of the phase, which you feed back to this local oscillator to give you some sort of approximation of the homodyne measurement. And this is the general motivation for this, though. It turns out that often using the best phase estimate in here doesn't actually give you good results. Anyway, so I'll give some more technical details of how this works. So you'll notice there's a difference here. It turns out the difference photo count between these two outputs is what's important. And we use the symbol I for that. And when you're looking at how to process that, you usually work it out in terms of this A and B parameters. And it turns out that if you combine them in this way to give you a C, then the phase of C is giving you a good estimate of the system phase. And another neat result is, so this A and B, that the subscript corresponds to these at the end of the measurement. And the A and B are what are sufficient statistics for the phase measurement, in the sense that you don't have to use any other information about that photo current. And the reason for that is that the P over M for the measurement only depends on the A and the B. And what you have is you have this Q here, which is essentially depending on what sort of measurement you're using, and this state here, which is proportional to a squeeze state. So what you end up with is something with an inner product between your system state and the squeeze state, so which tells you that essentially the minimum possible introduced phase uncertainty is going to correspond to the uncertainty of that squeeze state. And because you have this approximate result for the phase variance for optimally squeezed states, then that's going to also be the minimum introduced phase uncertainty. So if you're trying to actually approach this limit, what you're wanting to do is go back to this Q, because this Q is the only thing that's actually dependent on the measurement, and you want to try and engineer this Q such that it's giving you A's and B's that correspond to these parameters here, which are the same as optimally squeezed states. And if you work it through, it means that the absolute value of A at the end of the measurement should actually be scaled down with the mean photon number. And this is actually surprisingly difficult to get. And in some early work, there was a simple feedback scheme which actually gave the absolute value of A being equal to 1 at the end of the measurement, which is why that scheme wasn't close to optimal. So if you look at the actual differential equation in terms of expectation values for this, you end up with 1 minus this quantity here. And in that early scheme, the feedback phase was taken to be equal to R A V there. So this part was 0, which is why. So you just had this overall being dV. So we're integrating this, so this scale of times from 0 to 1, integrate that, and you get that going up to 1. So, but if you want this to be smaller than 1, you want this thing overall to be positive, which means you want this feedback phase to be between the system phase and this RGO. And the way of trying to achieve that is you look at using this CV, which is giving you the estimate of the system phase, and the AV, and use this epsilon to give you data to tune it to be something between those. And it turns out that it's very difficult to actually work out the value of epsilon that gives you good results, but if you use this value of epsilon, you actually get results that are very close to the theoretical limit, and actually are smaller than the theoretical limit for small photon numbers. And I should emphasise, this isn't a contradiction, it's just an approximate theoretical limit. So I should emphasise as well that this is meaning that you're not actually using that simple approach that I mentioned before of trying to approximate a homodyne measurement, because you're not using your best phase estimate in your feedback. Okay, another issue that I'll mention is trying to track a continuously fluctuating phase. So here you have a cavity with squeezing, which has some decay at the output, and this has continuous fluctuations on the phase here, which is just satisfying the usual relation for that. And you have in experimental phase some sort of feedback to this that's proportional to the difference photocurrent there. And you can work out an argument in terms of weighted averages, which tells you that the steady state variance, you should be going as roughly the square root of the 1 on n, where n is the flux. And if you compare this to what you'd have for a coherent state, you'd have 1 on the photon number for the coherent state. So you're actually getting a difference on the square root in there, which is coming from the difficulty in tracking a continuously fluctuating phase, because if you're looking back a certain amount of time, you can only look at back a limited amount of time, because beyond that, the phase would have changed too much to actually give you useful information. You get a similar result with limited squeezing, where you get an e to the minus r factor in there, whereas you get an e to the minus 2r if you're looking at a fixed phase. And then if you're looking at what happens with larger squeezing, you actually find that there's a couple of restrictions that you have there. One is that you have to look at times over of the order of e to the r or gamma, and also you have this contribution to the flux from the squeezing, and when you take those into account, you end up finding that the best you can do is this to the power of 5/8. See, so that's only a difference of 1/8 as compared to the coherent state phase. So I will also mention as well that you use a similar analysis to this in terms of using A's and B's, except these have a negative exponential weight on them. And when you work it out numerically, you find that the variance is actually very close to what's predicted. Let's skip over that part. Go back to that if you're interested. The main part I want to talk about for phase measurements is with Mach Zehnder interferometer. So if you're looking at the standard techniques for Mach Zehnder interferometer, you, for example, send independent photons through your interferometer and have estimates of your phase based on the photodetections at your output. And you can look at a linear variation of this similar to the heterodyne case. And then when you work out the uncertainty scaling for this, it's actually going as 1/13, which is the standard quantum limit scaling in. So to improve on that, one thing you can do is look at doing some general measurement on your output, which the optical tumour joint measurement was given in this reference. And even if provided you're using that input, that's still not enough to meet the standard quantum limit because of the actual intrinsic uncertainty of the state. But if you use a entangled input state, then you find that you can get the Heisenberg limit there. And you find that you're actually getting exactly the same result for this uncertainty here as for the intrinsic uncertainty when you have a maximum of n photons on your single mode state. So next question is how you'd actually go about doing this. So one idea is to try using this feedback approach. So after, in this case, each detection, you have a processor which processes the results of those detections and feeds back to that phase. And the principle that this uses is to use a Bayesian approach to work out the probability distribution for the phase and as well work out what the probability distribution for the phase would be for both possible measurement results and as well to estimate the probability of those measurement results to get an average expected variance after the next detection. And the phase that you pick here is the one that actually minimises the expected variance after the next detection. And numerically, it turns out that with that entangled input state, that it looks like you still get that 1/n scale into the variance.
How efficient are those Bayesian calculations?
Essentially, for each photon, you're adding another term to the representation of the distribution. So, and then to actually work out the optimal phase, it's a very quick calculation. So the main computational difficulty is actually keeping track of the coefficients and probability distribution. Okay, so next problem is how you actually create that input state. So there's two problems there. One is of having to create this massive superposition state at the input, and so that would be difficult enough, but you also need to try to create a very long mode because at this point, what you're essentially doing is saying that after each detection of each photon, you have to have enough time to feed back to that phase here before the next photon comes through. And that essentially means that you have to have a reasonably long mode. So one way of getting around this is looking at noon states. And for noon states, you essentially aren't doing any feedback there, and you find that you get 1/n inaccuracy, though you also only get a phase distribution that's ambiguous with a period of what they're evolving, a period of running, and also you find that these moon states are very difficult to, they're still very difficult to produce. So what we looked at was, rather than trying to generate moon states, was using multiple passes for a phase shift. So it turns out that even when you're doing this, you still get the same limit of the phase uncertainty. So, and again, you get these two, you again get this ambiguous phase distribution with n peaks there. So the next part of the scheme is to work out how to get rid of those the ambiguous peaks. This is from the Nature paper. So the idea is, after the first detection with, in this example, 8 passes, you adjust this phase here so that when you do another detection with 4 passes, you're actually eliminating half of those redundant peaks there. And the feedback again, and eliminate 2 more peaks. Feedback again, and eliminate the remaining peak. And then for this, you'll actually quantify, I should mention as well, that you're quantifying the total number of resources in terms of the total number of passes through that phase shift. So it's a total of 2 to the k plus 1 minus 1, where 2 to the k is the maximum number of passes. So this turns out to be exactly equivalent to Kido phase estimation from computing theory. So for this case, you would have a number of controlled unit trees, which gives you different powers of phases on a whole sequence of qubits, and then you use an inverse quantum Fourier transform to try to extract the bits representing that phase there. So to see how this is actually equivalent, you can decompose this inverse quantum Fourier transform into its circuit elements, and you can do a whole lot of simplifications, mainly involving moving these detections back through these quantum controlled operations to make them classically controlled. And then once you've done all these simplifications, you identify that the qubits are going to be dual rail single photons, and these Hadam arms are beam splitters. So you have beam splitter followed by this controlled U followed by beam splitter. So then you just replace that with the unknown phase in the interferometer. Then these are just turned into the feedback to that the theta phase. And then the last thing you do is you delay preparation of each of these qubits until after the preceding detection. So what this means is that you're just reusing the same interferometer. And when you look at it in this way, you can see that this, the Kitao phase estimation, is exactly what we had with that interferometer. So you can also see that the you actually have something equivalent to a heavily entangled state when you do this, because each measurement with the multiple passes is equivalent to a moon state. And in terms of its phase properties, this tensor product of moon states is equivalent to this equal superposition state. So this is actually eliminating both of those problems we had for how to create the input state, because first of all, we don't actually need to create this massive superposition state. We can just do something that's equivalent to this superposition state. And the next thing is, we don't actually need a long input mode, because we have independent photons and they only need to interfere with each other. They don't have to interfere with the other photons. Okay, so when we look at the variance for this, you can find that it has the probability distribution, although it has a narrow peak, it has high tails on it. And the high tails actually give you a variance scaling as 2 on n, which is again the standard quantum limit. So to give some motivation for how to beat that, if you look at what you need in terms of the state coefficients, you have this result, this was the approximate result for variance, where you introduce dummy coefficients at either end, and you can show that if you have something that's just scaling up from zero to a maximum, then back down to zero again for the state coefficient. So that should actually be giving you the Heisenberg scale. So if you look at that equivalent state for the Kitaev scheme, it was a flat distribution with these sharp jump down to these dummy state coefficients, the big ring, which is actually what the problem is. And in contrast, this is what an optimal state looks like. So now the idea is to repeat measurements n times. So this is the analysis for the case of repeating measurements two times, and you get this factor in here giving you this expression for the full weighting, which turns out to be equivalent to square root of the size of on a square. And if you're doing this repeating multiple times, you have it's equivalent to the size of a hyperplane going diagonally across the hypercube. And so for this case with n equal to 2, this is what you end up with, which gives you something very close to Heisenberg scaling, except the log n factor in there. But if you go to n equal to 3 and larger, you end up with the actual Heisenberg scale.
So what was the n again?
The n is the number of times, it's essentially the number of times you repeat the measurement for each number of passes.
Okay.
So when you do that, it means that you're essentially taking the tensor product on the intrinsic state.
Right. And the number of passes is the bit that you're trying to pin down in the phase representation, right? Like, if you're trying to get the k significant binary digit, you have k passes.
Okay.
And then you repeat that additional n times.
Yeah. But we have the complication here that rather than looking at something that's just an integer multiple of pi on 2 to the k, for example, that's going to be something arbitrary. So the Kitaev scheme works very well if you have something that's an integer multiple like that. Mm-hmm. But when it's not an integer multiple, it can have significant error of it. So that's what's giving the SQL scaling in that case. So looking at what we use as the feedback for this, we actually are using for these different cases with the same number of passes, we are adjusting this feedback phase to maximize the sharpness of each of these individual peaks after the next detection, in a similar way to the feedback scheme that I explained before with just a single pass. So you end up with successively sharper peaks after each detection, and this is a simulation of what it looks like with also eliminating these redundant peaks as well. So that's the important part. This is just coefficients of the probability distribution. So, okay. So anyway, when you do all that and do the numerics to work out what the expected variances are, you find that for n equal to 1, which is just one measurement for each number of passes, and is a good one to the Kitaev scheme, as I explained before, you get the same scaling as the standard quantum limit, and I should mention as well, this is all multiplied by variance times n. So the standard quantum limit goes across that way, and the Heisenberg limit goes down there. So, and you also find, surprisingly, that for n equal to 2, you get results that are basically identical to the n equal to 1 results. And this is essentially just because you can't your adaptive scheme isn't giving you something sufficiently close to an ideal measurement there. But you do get better scaling for n equal to 3, and then if you have n equal to 4 or larger, you find that you are getting this Heisenberg division scaling. So then this was actually done experimentally at Griffith, where they used two polarization modes in a single spatial mode. And so it looks more like this. This is what the equipment actually looked like. And they got the results looking like this. So there's essentially, they were going very close to the predicted results, except for some of these results up here, which were due to poor visibility. And for the largest number of resources there, we have better than a 10 decibel improvement in the variance. And if you were going to try to get that variance using the standard methods, you'd actually need 4,333 photons as opposed to 378 resources, which we have in this experiment. So anyway, so that's so just to summarise what I've gone over with the phase, showed that if you're looking at the measurements of a single node, you're essentially limited to introducing the phase uncertainty that's as much as what you get for optimal squeeze states, and it's actually possible to work out the feedback scheme which approaches that. We've also shown that you can track the phase, the variable phase, with a basically a square root of the factor in there as compared to a static phase, except for squeeze states, you're going to get a 5/8 scaling. And then for this scheme I've just explained, we have we're replacing these entangled measurements with adaptive measurements, and using and replacing entangled states with multiple passes of single photons through the phase shift, and that allows the Heisenberg limit to be achieved. And I've just got a reiteration of the Hamiltonian sections as well there. Thank you.
It seems that you're kind of comparing apples and oranges, in the sense that you define the Heisenberg limit to be one on n, where n is the number of photons.
Yeah.
And you said you achieved the Heisenberg limit, but really you're counting the number of passes, which is different.
Well, the thing is, if you were looking at it in terms of the number of photons, it'd be ridiculous.
I'm not necessarily an advocate of noon states.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that had I put a noon state into your multi-passer chronometer, I would still be getting...
If you put a noon state in rather than using the multiple passes, you could do everything exactly the same, except you'd be quantifying things in terms of the number of resources. But I should probably go back to... where we get all these animations. It's here somewhere. So it's up immediately after that. There we go. So it's this paper here is probably one you should look at, because that's looking at having repeated applications of the phase shift, and then showing that essentially having a repeated application of a phase shift is equivalent to doing things in parallel.
Mm.
And the important thing to quantify things in terms of is how many times you're actually implementing that phase shift.
Well, I think that's a very computer science perspective, not that there's anything wrong with that. But I mean, there are cases where your parallel resources are the things that you want to quantify. For example, the way they do Ramsey interferometry in NIST, right? They have some cloud of cold atoms, they have N atoms.
Yeah.
And in that case, they're performing the standard quantum limit, of course, with Ramsey interferometry, but the number of atoms in the cloud is their parallel number of resources. If they were to compare some cat state, then they would be doing Heisenberg limited interferometry. So I guess I'm just saying that, I guess what I'm trying to say is, it seems that there are two different things here, and that physically it's not always clear that they're equivalent.
Okay.
I mean, they can be formally equivalent, but it's not clear physically that they're equivalent.
It's about action, right? I mean,
yeah.
And the atoms is something, so that is a piece.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're showing too is that they're not the same physically, right? This experiment is presumably easier to do than to prepare noon states, right? Because people have been thinking about noon states for a long time, and they still activity.
Well, it can, but only with small numbers.
Right, that's what I mean. So you're showing an improvement, but I think it's maybe a little bit. I guess I'm just trying to say that it's not clear that you're comparing the same things. But it's okay because you're still doing improvement.
Yeah. Well, if you did want to quantify things in terms of number of passes, it's not really clear what you would quantify in terms of.
No, I'm happy to do that. Yeah. It's just, I think, well, there's this, I think the ultimate problem is the ambiguity in what it means to say Heisenberg limited.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to attack whoever invented that phrase. I'm not trying to come down hard on you, don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to point out this.
Yeah, that's very good.
That was a whole lot of material for me to try to keep up with. Of the results you showed several.
Yeah.
Which do you consider the most important in the sense of giving the longest term impact on quantum information? So just put it in perspective. Give me the one result so I can get back with that.
The one result, probably this Heisenberg unit, the interferometry. So. Because it's essentially what we have is an actual experimental demonstration of Kitto phase estimation, and as well as generalizations that actually give you better phase estimation than what Kitto's method gives you.
Okay. So you call that Kitaev's method, but that's not actually what he described in his 95 paper, because he did the corrections afterwards classically, and there's implicitly a log-n overhead to do it his way.
Oh, okay.
This is sort of the derived instances of the cleaned up version.
Simplified.
Without the overhead?
Yeah. This, if you do the corrections quantumly, then you lose that overhead that he had.
So, based on the question that Chris puts me, I mean, the more passes you have here, right, the more the error you, I mean, there's a probability of error in your scheme. So, I mean, how do you really expect that, you know, the Heisenberg limit or these things that go beyond the standard quantum limit would behave for a large number of passes versus, you know, standard quantum limit?
Well, what you mean in terms of scaling up the number of passes.
Mm-hmm.
So, really, what's limited the number of passes here is really that is just the actual linear dimension of the thing, because you have a certain spot size you have a certain diameter for this beam, and then you have a certain diameter for this mirror, and it actually looks like this, where you have a mirror with some width. You have to have this thing bouncing back and forth. It has to step across each time and have these not overlapping, and actually have to be able to put in a mirror here that's not going to pick off part of this beam. And the limitation there is just that this mirror is a multiple of the size of the beam. So we don't actually have that much problem with absorption in there. So in principle, if you can scale up the size of your mirror, then it's not going to be you're going to be able to scale up that number of passes as well.
So do you expect that this technique, I mean, will actually be what is, you know, positions that you can achieve today, let's say, in the standard one?
Even just using a small number of passes, you can imagine just scaling up the number of measurements you do for each number of passes, and you're still going to beat the same quantum limit, just not going to be going as the Heisenberg limit. And it's just for any set equipment, you're going to be limited in terms of the maximum number of passes you have. It's really the limitation there.
Well, let's thank Dominic again for his great talks.